Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to our 14th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson on the journalism faculty at the university, and with us tonight, it's the great privilege for us to have Christopher Buckley, who has worked in the magazine world and as a political speechwriter, but is most famous for his stinging satirical novels. He's written 12 of them at least, including Thank You for Smoking, which was made into a Hollywood movie, The White House Mess, Boomsday, and his most recent, Supreme Courtship. He was given the Washington Irving Prize for Literary Excellence and the Thurber Prize for American Humor. Mr. Buckley, welcome to our symposium.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Now, you started out in a family that had a famous writer for a father. Was there pressure on you to be a writer, or did this just come naturally to you?
Yes.
Okay.
No, there wasn't. My dad was, he was not, no father or mother would, I think, in his or her right mind, would push a child into the literary world. I mean, it would be, child services would be entitled to come and take you away. You know, you very generously rattled off my my CV there. I've been on a book tour, and I've written 13 or 14 books, and on the back flap you have, you know, the about the author paragraph, which is the paragraph that authors pretend they didn't write. You know, the one that says, considered a leading voice of his generation. Oh, no, I didn't write that. Yeah. But after seven or eight of these books, I got sort of bored with them, so I started to make them up.
Okay, I see where this is going. The Washington Irving Prize and the Thurber Prize.
No, that's actually real.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I didn't win the prizes. The prizes exist.
The prizes are real, yeah.
But in one of these books, it was called Little Green Men, and I wrote in the about the author, he has been an advisor to every American president since William Howard Taft. And Governor and Mrs. Dukakis, you may appreciate this story because you may have been on this radio show in Boston. There's a hierarchy out there in the radio world, and up here you've got NPR, you know, and down here you've got most of the radio stations I end up on, which are, you know, drive time AM talk show. I'm sure you've been on. And so it was about 2 weeks into this tour, and I was a little punchy, and I was in Boston, and going into an interview on this AM drive time talk radio show, and I walked into the studio, and the host, to use a somewhat elevated word for what he did, was sitting at his console speed reading the about the author paragraph. And I knew right away that this was all he would know about me, much less this book. And so he looked up with sort of beetled brow as I walked in, and he said, you're an advisor to William Howard Taft? And I was just punchy enough. I said, yeah. And he said, so we could talk about that? And I said, yeah. And we did. I have not been invited back on that radio show. But, you know, it was worth it. It was really worth it. Anyway, the rigors of the book tour.
Could we get back to what he just read to you.
Yeah. Not a word of that was true.
You okay now?
Yeah,
ready to go on? But all right, so the first book of yours that I read was God is My Broker. A monk tycoon reveals the 7.5 spiritual laws of spiritual and financial growth. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading this and thinking...
Fabulous book.
It was a fabulous book. But I remember reading it and thinking, wow, this guy totally gets the religious world, the financial world, you know, flawed human desires. But then every other book of yours that I've read, regardless of what it was about, I just thought, you totally get that world too. Thank You for Smoking, for instance. You just skewer. Well, I made a list. Here are all the groups that, here's the groups that you just attack with an acid-tipped spear. You go after business in general, but the tobacco industry specifically, politics, the news media, Hollywood, education, the prison system, political correctness, and self-righteous people in general. Those are all the people you go after in that book, and that's just that one. You obviously know all these groups. Do you just hate everybody?
Did you like my book about the white whale?
Is that the one that begins with, call me Christopher?
Yeah. I know a bit about whales, too.
Yeah.
Well, I live in Washington. I have, you know, I went down to write speeches for George Herbert Walker Bush in 1981. And while I was working at the White House, the bottom line of this story is, why I started doing this. Let me just give you the outline. Well, this is a college, right? And you'll be responsible for this on the final day. But while I was at the White House, I started reading White House memoirs, because everyone who works at the White House for more than 10 minutes writes an 800-page book. The subtext of which is, it would have been much worse if I hadn't been there. And I became fascinated by this genre, you know, John Early. It's a very rich field, and they're all, you know, grudge-carrying. When I left, I wrote a parody of a White House memoir. It's called The White House Mess, you know. So that's how it all sort of started.
Yeah, but do you just hate everybody? That was the question.
No, actually, I don't. In fact, I've been taken to task and severely criticized in a number of reviews for not being mean enough. There are some who many people, sophisticated readers, who like their satire savage. You know, they want it Swiftian. They want blood on the walls. And I'm not that angry a person. Look at me, you know. I'm well fed, you know. I got in good company. But you know, there is my stuff is not on this. On the other hand, without let me put it this way. I wrote 2 books ago, I think it was, a book called Boomsday, which is about. Which has a, you might say, Swiftian modest proposal on how to solve the looming Social Security crisis, which is the main character puts forward somewhat playfully the idea that the government should incentivize baby boomer suicide as a means of solving the Social Security crisis. And an ambitious senator running for president picks it up and makes it the centerpiece of his presidential campaign. So, you know, that's a serious sort of...
Yeah, actually, I want to talk about Boomsday for a second, yeah. because Boomsday, that whole thing about the Social Security and it being troubled, that was before it became a big national issue to talk about Social Security reform. You wrote that. Let me finish.
I can't claim. I bet Governor Dukakis has said a thing or two about Social Security reform back in the 1980s.
But if you put that together with what you said about smoking in Thank You for Smoking, which was before the executives from the tobacco industry stood up and said cigarettes are not addictive, And then you give us Supreme Courtship, which has
marvelous book.
Yeah, it is a marvelous book.
On sale in the lobby.
Will you let me finish? Which has the president naming a person to the Supreme Court, this foxy TV judge who loves guns, and it's this cross between Sarah Palin and Judge Judy, and all of this happens before it actually before there was a Sarah Palin. Can you see the future? You write these fiction pieces, and then they come true.
Well, that one was kind of funny. This is the current novel, and it's about a president who gets frustrated because his arch enemy, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has it in for him and keeps turning down his Supreme Court nominees, and so he. One night, he's in bed with the Dwight, the first golden retriever, and they're trying to find the bowling channel. He's from Ohio, the president, and he likes to bowl. And he comes on this courtroom show with this very sexy woman who you have accurately described. So you left out that she wears glasses.
Yeah. She did wear glasses. It was
glasses,
perfect.
Glasses,
it was perfect.
And she wears a gun, and you know, she's from Texas. And so he thinks, well, you son of a bitch, let's see you try to shoot her down, because she's very popular. And her antagonist, this Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, is a cosmetically enhanced, logorrheic U.S. senator who's run for president a number of times, and his wife is on the board of Amtrak. And they have a dog, in fact, named Amtrak. And... So this was a novel I handed in last January, a year ago, in which the two antagonists are a glasses-wearing, gun-toting TV hottie and a Botoxed, talkative U.S. senator. And... Yeah, and the it came out the day after McCain picked Sarah Palin. You know,
that's my point.
Well, you know,
can you see into the future?
Do you remember Tom Lehrer?
Sure, sure.
Some of you, I think, are old enough to remember Tom Lehrer. Really great. And he announced that he was going to give up satire the day Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize. Because he said there was just no longer any point. I felt a little bit that way about Supreme Courtship. It's, you know, writing satire in America today is pointless. Because you're in a losing competition with USA Today. You know. Some years ago, do we have time for me to string out this?
I've forgotten whose interview this was. Go ahead.
Some years ago, I became sort of intrigued by the profusion of books about fly fishing. Have you noticed this? Fly fishing used to be fly fishing. You go stand in an ice cold water up to your for 6 hours, not catch anything, but still, he had a pretty good time. And then people started writing books that invested fly fishing with sort of mystical properties. There was, you know, fly fishing through the divorce, fly fishing through the refinancing of the subprime mortgage, how I found God through fly fishing, was standing in ice cold water. That probably did it for some of the old prophets. But you'd go into Barnes & Noble and you'd be, you know, fiction, nonfiction, fly fishing. But I have a point. No, there's a point to this. So I wrote a piece for The New Yorker. It was in the form of reviews in brief, just brief paragraphs, on the new crop of books about fly fishing. There were 6 books. And there was, you know, one of them was Peter Benchley's new novel, Gills, about about a vengeful trout. There was another book. The title was Bass Holes. And this was a book. It was an attack on bass fishermen by a really sort of prissy, dry fly, barbless, you know, fisherman who thought that bass fishing was for proletarians and they cared only about women with big breasts and beer. You know, sounded pretty good to me. Anyway, the point of my story is that people started going into books. This is humor on the back page of The New Yorker, right? It said shouts and murmurs. Yeah. People started going into bookstores and asking for these books. And the book that they most wanted was Bass Holes. You know? And they'd go up to the guy at the cash register and said, you know, where's Bass Holes? I can't find Bass Holes. And so he's doing the thing. He goes, no. But, you know, only... It's like... remember what Yogi Berra said when he was told that a Jewish man had been elected mayor of Dublin? He said, only in America. But you were saying. You were saying.
You know, just listening to you, were you just surrounded by pretentious gas bags everywhere?
Pretty much.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I was sent off to monks at the age of 13.
And then raised by wolves after that?
No, the wolves came first. I was with monks for 4 years, you know. And, you know, all these altar boy scandals, the molestation things. I have to say, I was with monks for 4 years, and honestly, in that whole length of time, not one of them ever laid a hand on me other than to beat me savagely.
How lucky were you?
And now I'm left to wonder, was I that unattractive? another 10,000 years in purgatory.
But. Yeah, actually, I don't think this is going to make it to television at all. All right, now, if I could ask you something about writing, maybe.
You know, I thought we agreed we weren't going to talk about
it. I do have to give a couple of great lines from some of your books, talking about speechwriters. I mean, you were in the White House as a speechwriter. You've got this great line in one of your books. Speechwriters are fundamentally Calvinistic. They become nervous if their principals exhibit free will and depart from the prepared text. Was that true? Did you just, if you saw one of the people you wrote a speech for wander off of that, were you just...
Can I tell a story? I know you don't like it when I tell a story.
Yeah, sure.
Should I tell a story?
Yeah.
See, they want me to tell a story. I wrote speeches for George Herbert Walker Bush, and I had I had gone down to Washington. I was 28, and you know it's a it felt like you know it was a Mr. Smith goes to Washington moment where you go to Washington, you're young, you're idealistic. I was going to be chief speechwriter to the Vice President of the United States, and it sounds like Austin Powers, you know. But I thought, you know, this is going to change the course of history. My speeches will be reprinted in full on the front page of the New York Times. They'll be studied in the Kremlin. This is, you know, they're going to absolutely turn the tide of history. And then it took me about 48 hours to realize that it doesn't matter what vice presidents say. We could never get any press coverage from Mr. Bush's speeches. The only press coverage we got was the guy from C-SPAN who would come and set up his camera on a tripod in the back of the room, then go smoke in the lobby. This is just in case someone shot him. So I thought, well, this is going to be a drag, you know. And then one day in December of 1981, the Cold War heated up. Remember the Cold War? Don't you miss the Cold War? You know, it was so much more fun than this one. The Poles declared martial law in Poland, and Russian tank divisions were moving in, and we went from, you know, DEFCON 4 to DEFCON 3. I bet, you know how noisy it is at Coronado here? I bet it got really noisy. And Mr. Bush was scheduled to give a speech anyway the next day. So it was decided that he would give the official administration response to this provocation. So I thought, wow, you know, this is so great. My moment has arrived. So I wrote the speech, and being a highly intellectual, sophisticated person, I went to Bartlett's familiar quotations and found a quote from Thucydides. And so it was always nice to have a little classical parsley, you know, and the thing. And so he's giving a speech. You know, we had a huge audience, big press coverage, you know, live network feeds. And Mr. Bush, lovely guy, he's up there. He's doing great. And he gets, until he gets to this Thucydides line, he goes, as the Greek historian and he's saying, he's going, ooh. Yeah. And he was like a parrot with a piece of banana. I was sitting at the staff table with Admiral Murphy, who was the four-star Navy admiral who was Mr. Bush's chief of staff. And, you know, I'd been with the Benedictine monks for 4 years, and I thought I knew something about symbols of, you know, authority people. And then I went to work for a four-star Navy admiral, and boy, are they strict, you know. There may be some of you here tonight. This is San Diego. And so Murphy's glowering at me. Bush is still going, ooh, ooh, ooh. Sounds like he's got a speech impediment. And I'm saying, I didn't make up this word, you know. It was like being in Lamaze class. I was going, you know, push, just push, push, push. And finally he spat it out. Okay, it's you know. And afterwards, Admiral Murphy came up and he jabbed me in the chest with his finger and said, "Next time, say Plato." So that was the beginning of the Platonic era of Bush rhetoric, which I think Governor Dukakis remembers from his campaign. But anyway.
Let me ask you something you're working on now. I understand you're working on a memoir that has to do, in part, with losing both your parents in the last year.
Yeah, it's not a comic novel.
No.
I lost both my parents last year, and they were, you know, one was William F. Buckley, the other was Pat Buckley, and they were, it's a cliche, but they were sort of larger-than-life people, and I had not planned to write a book about them, and then one day I just sort of sat down and it just kind of poured out. Anyway, it's coming out in May. It's called Losing Mom and Pop, and it's a memoir of losing the two of them. It opens with an epigraph from Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. You may remember this. Lady Bracknell says, and what about your parents? And Jack Worthing says, I have lost both my parents. Lady Bracknell says, lost both? To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, is a misfortune. To lose two looks like carelessness. So couldn't resist that.
You know, there are a lot of people who will be watching this and some who are in our audience today who are just getting started in a writing career or want to be writers. What kind of advice would you have for people who want to write?
Well, I think it's a tremendous thing to do. I'm glad I didn't know when I graduated from college what's involved, because it's probably like many, many other fields, it's hard to make a good living at it. If you enjoy nice French wines and fancy restaurants, you might consider law school. But, I feel about it the way, you know, the old song goes, birds gotta sing, girls gotta dance, whatever. It's, I would say, and this may be either a truism or a cliche, but you've got to give it absolutely everything you got and then some. Having said this, I realize this is probably true of practicing medicine or going into politics and becoming governor, running for president, devoting his life to public service, as Governor Dukakis has. But I think it is true from what I know of writing that you got to give it 110%. My great hero was Tom Wolfe. He was sort of the guy that made people of my generation want to be writers because he, reading his prose was like nitrous injected English language. You just didn't realize the English language could perform this way. And I remember being horrified in my 20s. I got to know him a little bit when he told me that he thought it took 10 years to learn how to write. And I thought, 10 years? Who's got time? Who's got 10 years? Now I've been at it, I'm into my third decade anyway. And I would say it takes maybe 20. Now it depends on how much talent you have. I had to work. I was not the classic A student. I had to work at it. But if you want to do it, go for it. Go for it. But and in the end, you either write or you don't write. An elderly, distinguished British director once. A friend of mine said something that I thought very telling. He said he can usually, when he's talking to a young person, he can tell by the way they phrase it whether or not they're going to be writers. The ones who say, I want to be a writer, as opposed to, I want to write. It's the ones who say, I want to write, are the ones who are probably going to give it the energy that it takes. A lot of people think, there's something romantic about being a writer. Well, look at me. Do I look romantic in the least? So, anyway.
Christopher Buckley, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.